An Essay Upon the Development of Christian Doctrine by John Henry Newman. Chapter 2, Part 3. Section 2. An Infallible Developing Authority to be Expected. It has now been made probable that the developments of Christianity were but natural as time went on, and were to be expected, and that these natural and true developments, as being natural and true, were of course contemplated and taken into account by its author, who, in designing the work, designed its legitimate results. These, whatever they turn out to be, may be called absolutely the developments of Christianity. That, beyond reasonable doubt, there are such, is surely a great step gained in the inquiry. It is a momentous fact. The next question is, what are they? And to a theologian who could take a general view, and also possessed an intimate and minute knowledge of its history, they would doubtless, on the whole, be easily distinguishable by their own characters, and require no foreign aid to point them out, no external authority to ratify them. But it is difficult to say who is exactly in this position. Considering that Christians, from the nature of the case, live under the bias of the doctrines, and in the very midst of the facts, and during the process of the controversies, which are to be the subject of criticism, since they are exposed to the prejudices of birth, education, place, personal attachment, engagements, and party, it can hardly be maintained that in matter of fact a true development carries with it always its own certainty, even to the learned, or that history, past or present, is secure from the possibility of a variety of interpretations. I have already spoken on this subject, and from a very different point of view from that which I am taking at present. Prophets or doctors are the interpreters of the revelation. They unfold and define its mysteries. They illuminate its documents. They harmonize its contents. They apply its promises. Their teaching is a vast system, not to be comprised in a few sentences, not to be embodied in one code or treatise, but consisting of a certain body of truth, pervading the church like an atmosphere, irregular in its shape from its very profusion and exuberance, at times separate only in idea from episcopal tradition, yet at times melting away into legend and fable. Partly written, partly unwritten, partly the interpretation, partly the supplement of Scripture. Partly preserved in intellectual expressions, partly latent in the spirit and temper of Christians. Poured to and fro in closets and upon the housetops, in liturgies, in controversial works, in obscure fragments, in sermons, in popular prejudices, in local customs. This I call prophetical tradition, existing primarily in the bosom of the church itself, and recorded in such measure as Providence has determined in the writings of eminent men. Keep that which is committed to thy charge, is St. Paul's injunction to Timothy, and for this reason, because from its vastness and indefiniteness it is especially exposed to corruption, if the church fails in vigilance. This is that body of teaching which is offered to all Christians, even at the present day, though in various forms and measures of truth, in different parts of Christendom, partly being a comment, partly an addition upon the articles of the creed. If this be true, certainly some rule is necessary for arranging and authenticating these various expressions and results of Christian doctrine. No one will maintain that all points of belief are of equal importance. There are what may be called minor points, which we may hold to be true without imposing them as necessary. There are greater truths and lesser truths, points which it is necessary and points which it is pious to believe. The simple question is, how are we to discriminate the greater from the less, the true from the false? This need of an authoritative sanction is increased by considering, after Monsieur Guizot's suggestion, that Christianity, though represented in prophecy as a kingdom, came into the world as an idea rather than an institution, and has had to wrap itself in clothing and fit itself in with armor of its own providing, and to form the instruments and methods of its prosperity and warfare. If the developments which have above been called moral are to take place to any great extent, and without them it is difficult to see how Christianity can exist at all, if only its relations toward civil government have to be ascertained, or the qualifications for the profession of it have to be defined, surely an authority is necessary to impart decision to what is vague and confidence to what is empirical, to ratify the successive steps of so elaborate a process, and to secure the validity of inferences which are to be made the premises of more remote investigations. Tests, it is true, for ascertaining the correctness of developments in general, may be drawn out, as I shall show in the sequel. But they are insufficient for the guidance of individuals in the case of so large and complicated a problem as Christianity, though they may aid our inquiries and support our conclusions in particular points. They are of a scientific and controversial, not of a practical character, and are instruments rather than warrants of right decisions. Moreover, they rather serve as answers to objections brought against the actual decisions of authority than are proofs of the correctness of those decisions. While then, on the one hand, it is probable that some means will be granted for ascertaining the legitimate and true developments of revelation, it appears, on the other, that these means must of necessity be external to the developments themselves. Reasons shall be given in this section for concluding that, in proportion to the probability of true developments of doctrine and practice in the divine scheme, so is the probability also of the appointment in that scheme of an external authority to decide upon them, thereby separating them from the mass of mere human speculation, extravagance, corruption, and error, in and out of which they grow. This is the doctrine of the infallibility of the Church. For by infallibility, I suppose, is meant the power of deciding whether this, that, and a third, and any number of theological or ethical statements, are true. Let the state of the case be carefully considered. If the Christian doctrine, as originally taught, admits of true and important developments, as was argued in the foregoing section, this is a strong antecedent argument in favor of a provision in the dispensation for putting a seal of authority upon those developments. The probability of their being known to be true varies with that of their truth. The two ideas, indeed, are quite distinct, I grant, of revealing and of guaranteeing a truth, and they are often distinct in fact. There are various revelations all over the earth which do not carry with them the evidence of their divinity. Such are the inward suggestions and secret illuminations granted to so many individuals. Such are the traditionary doctrines which are found among the heathen, that vague and unconnected family of religious truths, originally from God, but sojourning, without the sanction of miracle or a definite home, as pilgrims up and down the world, and discernible and separable from the corrupt legends with which they are mixed, by the spiritual mind alone. There is nothing impossible in the notion of a revelation occurring without evidences that it is a revelation. Just as human sciences are a divine gift, yet are reached by our ordinary powers and have no claim on our faith. But Christianity is not of this nature. It is a revelation which comes to us as a revelation, as a whole, objectively, and with a profession of infallibility. And the only question to be determined relates to the matter of the revelation. If, then, there are certain great truths or duties or observances, naturally and legitimately resulting from the doctrines originally professed, it is but reasonable to include these true results in the idea of the revelation itself, to consider them parts of it. And if the revelation be not only true, but guaranteed as true, to anticipate that they too will come under the privilege of that guarantee. Christianity, unlike other revelations of God's will, except the Jewish, of which it is a continuation, is an objective religion, or a revelation with credentials. It is natural, I say, to view it wholly as such, and not partly sui generis, partly like others. Such as it begins, such let it be considered to continue. Granting that certain large developments of it are true, they must surely be accredited as true. An objection, however, is often made to the doctrine of infallibility in limine, which is too important not to be taken into consideration. It is urged that, as all religious knowledge rests on moral evidence, not on demonstration, our belief in the Church's infallibility must be of this character. But what can be more absurd than a probable infallibility, or a certainty resting on doubt? I believe because I am sure, and I am sure because I suppose. Granting, then, that the gift of infallibility be adapted, when believed, to unite all intellects in one common confession, the fact that it is given is as difficult of proof as the developments which it is to prove, and nugatory, therefore, and, in consequence, improbable in a divine scheme. The advocates of Rome, it has been urged, insist on the necessity of an infallible guide in religious matters, as an argument that such a guide has really been accorded. Now it is obvious to inquire how individuals are to know with certainty that Rome is infallible. How any ground can be such as to bring home to the mind infallibly that she is infallible? What conceivable proof amounts to more than a probability of the fact? And what advantage is an infallible guide if those who are to be guided have, after all, no more than an opinion, as the Romanists call it, that she is infallible? This argument, however, except when used, as is intended in this passage, against such persons as would remove all imperfections in the proof of religion, is certainly a fallacious one. For since, as all allow, the apostles were infallible, it tells against their infallibility or the infallibility of Scripture as truly as against the infallibility of the Church. For no one will say that the apostles were made infallible for nothing. Yet we are only morally certain that they were infallible. Further, if we have but probable grounds for the church's infallibility, we have but the like for the impossibility of certain things, the necessity of others, the truth, the certainty of others. And therefore the words infallibility, necessity, truth, and certainty ought all of them to be banished from the language. But why is it more inconsistent to speak of an uncertain infallibility than of a doubtful truth or a contingent necessity, phrases which present ideas clear and undeniable? In sooth, we are playing with words when we use arguments of this sort. When we say that a person is infallible, we mean no more than that what he says is always true, always to be believed, always to be done. The term is resolvable into these phrases as its equivalents. Either, then, the phrases are inadmissible, or the idea of infallibility must be allowed. A probable infallibility is a probable gift of never erring. A reception of the doctrine of a probable infallibility is faith and obedience towards a person founded on the probability of his never erring in his declarations or commands. What is inconsistent in this idea? Whatever, then, be the particular means of determining infallibility, the abstract objection may be put aside. End of part 3.